Do you have any sort of ballpark percentage of properties that you would consider just simply are not buys?
I would say over half. We get a lot in through pay-per-click nowadays, too. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a combination of the mailer ones and the pay-per-click ones. Combined total, it's more than half. But for the pay-per-click ones only, I would say about 75% of those are ones we don't want to buy. And then for the mailer ones, maybe a little less than half.
Welcome to Turning Profit, a podcast for people that love real estate. Learn the business models and skills that professional real estate investors use to make money and build wealth. Visit turningprofit.com for a wealth of investor resources. And now, here are your hosts, Pete and Heather Reese.
Welcome to the Turning Profit podcast. Maddie, it's so great to be here once again.
Yay! Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Yes. Well, very special. If you've noticed that Maddie is joining me as the co-host today,
yep.
Filling Heather's seat.
Yes.
Those are big shoes to fill, Maddie.
It's true. So. It's true. She's about a shoe size bigger than me.
Yes. So. Heather has got something else going on today. So Maddie graciously offered to step in as the co-host for the Turning Profit podcast. And, you know, I've been wanting to have you on the podcast again. You were on a previous episode. I don't know what number that was. Maybe two or three or four, somewhere around there.
Yeah, one of the early ones.
One of the first ones we filmed where we were talking about your own land flipping adventures.
Yep.
And how you kind of started at you and your sister, yes. Ashley, who's not here in this filming today. But you started at 8,000 and then you parlayed that into 85,000.
Yes.
And since then, you've been doing other land flipping and everything.
Yeah.
But the big thing is that you have you've gotten heavily involved in behind the scenes on our business as well.
Yes.
So maybe just kind of an overview of what you do is you're kind of evaluating all the properties that come in. You look at them in detail and you determine what you think they're worth and if they're properties that we're interested in buying.
Yeah.
So
that's the big one, if we're interested in buying them.
Yes.
Because as you'll hear today, there are some pieces of land that we don't want to buy.
Yes.
At any price.
Yeah, that's right. Some pieces of land you just don't want to buy. And that's the topic of today's episode is... seven types of land to never buy at any price.
Nice. You know what? I think that we can.
Yeah, is that too dramatic?
Seven. I think is a good number. A good descriptor of that.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about, you know, I was trying to kind of brainstorm the types of land that I didn't want to buy, and you know, I just kind of brainstormed everything, and we ended up at seven. I'm sure there are other pieces of land that I wouldn't buy as well that fall into a different category, but that's all I could think of.
Yeah.
Well, from our experience, I mean, you get to see all the leads that come in.
Yeah.
And I know from the very beginning, I was always under the impression that, heck, I would buy any piece of land if it was the right price.
Yeah.
But but you see that there's a lot of pieces of land that come in that we're just simply not interested in buying.
Yeah.
For various reasons.
Exactly. Right? And it's hard to, even seeing these properties, it's hard to get out of that trap of thinking, oh, well, maybe there's some price that could work. Like, you don't want to turn down a potential deal. But the reality is a lot of these are not deals.
So would you say, like, what percentage of the leads that – because you're dealing with this every day. You're seeing all the leads that come in. Do you have any sort of, like, ballpark percentage of properties that you would consider just simply are not buys?
I would say over half.
Over half.
Over half are ones that – we get a lot in through pay-per-click nowadays, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a combination of the mailer ones and the pay-per-click ones. So I would say combined total, it's more than half. But for the pay-per-click ones only, I would say about 75% of those are ones we don't want to buy.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the mailer ones, maybe a little less than half.
A little less than half are the ones that we would buy or wouldn't
that
buy?
That we wouldn't buy.
That we wouldn't buy. Okay. Yeah. So a greater percentage on the mail, it's kind of like generally higher quality properties that come through.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're with the direct mail, we're really fine tuning our list ahead of time. Like we're sorting it by the types of properties there are and everything. So the properties that we, you know, are sending out mail to are ones that generally, you know, on the surface we would want to buy. Now with the pay-per-click, it's kind of like It's just people respond to our ad on Google that says, sell my land for cash or something like that. And then they fill out our form. So if you're interested in that, we actually did an episode about 2 weeks ago on pay-per-click and our results with the company that does all of our pay-per-click ads for us. And that's called Bateman Collective. But if you do go there, tell them Pete sent you, by the way. But anyhow, so there's a different types of leads that come in, different types of properties and things like that. Yeah. So you're saying on the pay-per-click stuff, there's a greater percentage of properties that just we simply wouldn't want at any price, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've broken these all into categories. Nice. And one way to think about it is that these pieces of land are either assets or liabilities. So assets obviously would be something that would add to your net worth or your business's overall worth. And then liabilities are things that take away from it. So some of these properties are not even in the asset category. I would not consider them in an asset category because they're more of a liability.
Yep.
So we're going to go through some of these reasons why I consider that the case. Okay, so number one, land that is not developable. That's a very hard word to say.
It is.
Examples of this are pieces of land that are, I see this a lot, pieces of land that are tucked between existing subdivisions.
Yes.
You see that, you know, like they're, we kind of internally call them like subdivision leftovers.
Yes.
Yes. Yep. And if you tried to approach the city or the county about developing that property, most of the time they would say, well, it can't be developed because, you know, for whatever reason, it's just simply a buffer, a green zone, drainage area, all kinds of things like that come up. Sometimes we see stuff like HOA common areas and things that are permanently designated as something that you can't build on.
Yeah.
And people contact us and are interested in selling them. So I don't know what you would do with that. But
don't know.
Yeah. Properties like that are more of a liability because it's not developable.
No.
Recreationally, it's tough to do anything with them because they're next to these huge subdivisions. Mm-hmm. And you're simply going to have to pay property taxes on those every year.
Exactly.
Some other things. A land that is permanently designated as open space.
Yes. Yeah. So. And that one's kind of it's not something you immediately think of. So it's one you have to dig in a little deeper to find out, because sometimes you'll see a property and you'll think, oh, okay, this looks like it has some potential.
Yeah.
And then you kind of, you have to research a little more and you'll see, oh, okay. Yeah.
You kind of glossed over, you have to research it a little more. How would you determine that?
Okay. So a good way to do that is by going on the county GIS. That's a kind of an easy way. Typically you can search by the parcel number or by the address if there is one, or put in a neighbor address to kind of zero in on the property. But they'll have zoning overlays, and that'll help you identify what properties are zoned for, what they're designated as, and you'll be able to see, okay, this one is open space, this one's commercial, this one's residential. Kind of depends. But in counties that don't have the GIS, sometimes they'll have kind of PDF map overlays of the entire city or the municipality, and that will kind of, that's more tedious because you kind of really have to zero in, and sometimes they're hard to read because they upload like these bad copies, but that's kind of the second best way to figure it out.
Yeah, and then if you can't figure it out online, or if there's some question marks, always good to call.
Yeah.
Always good to call and talk to them and just say, hey, I'm thinking about buying this piece of property. Yeah. What can I do with it? Mm-hmm. It says open space online, but what does that mean?
Can't hurt.
And they'll tell you most of the time, you know, if it says something like open space, that it can't be developed for whatever reason. So just very limited use. And something like that, unless you have some sort of very specific use that you're thinking of that fits within the allowed uses for this open space stuff, it's more of a liability than an asset.
Exactly.
Number two, this is kind of a big category. And this is a category that kind of scares me in a way. Mm. And it's, you know, we haven't bought anything in this category, but we were close before and I didn't even realize it. So number two is land that is environmentally contaminated.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Yeah.
That's a big one, because it's hard to identify.
Yeah. It's hard to identify sometimes. And, you know, these landfills, you know, it could be a landfill from the 30s, the 40s, you know, something like that. And then all of this trash and everything that was you know, this piece of property was used as a landfill during that time, and all the area people would bring their trash there, and then they buried it, and the years have passed, and it's still underneath there with who knows what kind of hazardous chemicals leaking into the groundwater, and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And, you know, that's more of a liability than an asset, because you simply don't want that liability and someone to come back and say, oh, your property is leaching into the groundwater and causing, you know, cancer in this area or something like that. Like, it's just a, I don't know, something to stay away from. Yes. We had a couple of properties actually in the past where we didn't realize that when we were buying it. And I remember one in specific, it came back on the title report and it said, you know, registered as a landfill in 1952 or whatever. And we're like, what? The seller didn't tell us that.
Oh,
and,
yeah, of course not.
The seller didn't tell us that. And you can't tell from looking at the property. No, I mean, it just, I don't know, looks like there's just nothing there, a piece of land. So I'm kind of nervous about that. The other thing that scares me too is, and this has happened before too, where we send someone out to check out the property in person, and there are drums of some sort of liquid.
Who knows what?
Yeah, who knows what? Chemical of some sort. Maybe it's used motor oil, or who knows what? But those types of things really worry me, because that's a potential environmental contaminant. And even if none of those barrels leaked into the ground or anything like that, you're still going to have to pay someone probably a very large sum of money in order to dispose that property. And I certainly don't recommend that you just roll them down by the river and do that and dump them in there. Don't do that. So in order to get rid of the stuff correctly, it's probably, you know, it may cost you more than what the property's worth.
Yeah.
So that worries me too.
Yeah.
And then, you know, sometimes there are former industrial sites where there's known contamination in the ground, or at least some of the local people may know that there's known contamination in the ground, and you would have to go through all kinds of steps in order to clean that up, which is expensive and, you know, and again, probably more costly the cleanup than the property is actually worth.
Yeah. And, you know, your second point brings up a really good point about why we get boots on the ground or photographers, because sometimes you won't see on the satellite images or the street view if there are, like, toxic waste drums on the property. You won't know that until you get someone to actually go there and they can see, like, oh, okay. Not sure what this is, but it doesn't look good.
Yes. You know, we talk about this sometimes. We mentioned this before about how you bought a property one time with tires.
Tires, yeah.
And not just a couple tires. No. These were like semi big rig tires.
Yeah.
And you can actually see them from space in the satellite images. That's a potential, you know, I guess a potential environmental contaminant. You know, it ended up being fine in your situation because you just resold them with the tires and the end buyer was fine with it. Yeah, but
didn't mention it at all, actually. So
something to be cautious about, at least. Yes, you know, you just have to kind of figure out, like, how does this affect the value of the property? And is it going to affect it a huge amount, a little bit? Because if you were to pay someone to remove those, that probably would have cost quite a bit of money.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you don't want to burn them or anything like that.
No, and it kind of is not just the value of the property, but I mean, if the property will sell in a timely manner at all.
Right.
Like, even if you price it really cheap, if you have these identified toxic waste drums on the property and they're front and center, everyone can see them.
Yeah, yeah. No one's really going to want to take a risk. That's tough to sell. That really affects the marketability.
Yes, exactly.
Want to learn the secret to building a thriving land flipping business? Head on over to landconquest.com and join over 2,000 passionate land flippers leveraging the power of community to scale quickly. Sign up for free at landconquest.com. All right, let's get back to the show. The next category is inaccessible land. Yeah. So there's a couple things in this category. First of all, landlocked.
Yeah.
So landlocked is basically land that's on an island, meaning it's trapped in between other neighboring parcels, and there is no access to a public roadway.
Yeah.
So these types of properties are not worthless per se. The value of them is much less. And depending on the area, you know, certain areas have allowances for you to be able to, if your property is landlocked, you have certain rights to be able to access your property through neighboring properties and things like that. You can't ever develop these landlocked properties. And always there's a potential for being able to sell this property to a neighbor or potentially establish a legal access in some way. Mm-hmm. But as it's sitting in its current state, landlocked properties are properties that I don't buy. The value is pretty low unless you've got a helicopter.
Yeah, that's true. So, and if you do, then...
personal drone type things, which are going to be coming. I do think that that's a potential area for investment, right? Speculation. No, but so there's the inaccessible, the landlocked stuff, but then there's also properties that are just really, really remote and hard to get to. So maybe it's a mountainside type property and there's, you know, maybe there's some, on paper, there's some legal access, but actually getting to the property is another thing.
It's just like
treacherous.
Going up like that. Technically, there's a road, but you'd have to get out your mountaineering equipment.
Yes. If you were a mountaineer, you know, maybe that would be desirable property. But for most of us, we don't want those types of properties. So number three was inaccessible land.
Yes.
Okay. Now this one is another one that I would consider as well. Harsh climate land.
Okay.
So this is what I would consider, you know, land that's maybe in the middle of like the Mojave Desert or, you know, maybe the polar ice caps or, you know, something like that. Like very unforgiving mountaintops somewhere like, you know, Donner Pass or something like that. I'm sure
that might go for a lot.
Yeah. but harsh type things like that are limit the usability.
Yes.
So how do you feel about those types of properties?
I mean, I don't like them. No, I typically they're ones where I can identify pretty quickly. I'll just open up the map and I'll say, okay, this is not one that we're going to be buying. Typically there's limited utilities, access to water, even if you were to get a well, is hard. It's just not typically places where people would want to live or be. I mean, if you're out in the middle of the desert and there's nothing around you for 2 hours and you can't get water, you can't get electricity. I mean, maybe there's someone out there who would like to live like that, but the use cases are very, very limited.
You know, we've driven out to Las Vegas from San Diego many times, and there's this freeway, the 15 freeway, that cuts right through kind of like a very harsh desert area. And in the middle of the summer especially, it's just so hot.
Oh, it's miserable.
And you know, you kind of look at every once in a while, you see, you know, a little home way off in the distance, you know, in the middle of the desert. And you're like, boy, that is just harsh. Yeah. You know, that's got to be rough to live there. But I guess to each their own. But these are not the types of properties that we would buy.
No.
So unless I'm starting to think that some of those desert property, maybe I should be buying up desert property for big solar farms. But
yeah, you know what?
But unless there's another utility. Utility. Yeah. Here's another one that doesn't get talked about very much. Land that is very expensive to hold.
Yes, this is a big one.
Some areas have super high property taxes and or maybe some other sort of maintenance requirement of them where you've actually got to invest quite a bit of money to even to own the property and has maybe limited development potential or something. Not even because it's like undevelopable, but maybe there's just not a lot of demand in that area, you know, something like that. So properties like that are difficult to hold because no one really wants them. You might have high property taxes and it's just like, what are you doing? It's just like paying money out and you get nothing, no real benefit from it.
No. Another one I would mention in that category is there are a lot of kind of pre-built subdivisions around the country, in Arkansas, some in Florida, where they're mostly undeveloped. There are some people living there, but they have really high property taxes or HOA taxes.
Yeah, HOA fees too.
HOA fees. Yeah. If there aren't many people who are wanting to move there or are wanting to purchase these properties, so you're going to be stuck paying these HOA fees.
Yes.
For years and years.
Yeah, you know what? That I've had people offer actually to just deed me their properties.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then when I looked into it, I'm like, well, okay, well, this property, you know, the market value is a couple thousand because because the HOA fees are so high.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And you to even just own the property, it doesn't really make sense to just own a piece of land. Like if you're going to have a house and you get some utility out of it, you know, that would be fine. But to just own that piece of land and hold it and pay the property taxes, the HOA fees and everything, it's just kind of pointless. So
the only way I could see it working is if you weren't going to build a house on the property, is if you lived nearby and you wanted to use some of the amenities. Mm. But most of the people who we see wanting to sell these properties don't live anywhere nearby. They live across the country. They bought it because they thought it seemed like a good deal.
Yes, they have. They had some sort of developer, had some sort of presentation, and then they bought it.
And now they're stuck with it.
Yes.
So it's very rarely someone who's actually been using the amenities or anything that's been just been like, oh, I'm done using it.
Yeah.
That's pretty rare.
Next one I've got, number six, is land with open legal disputes or title problems.
Ooh, yes.
Okay, yeah. So we run into the title problems a lot. Mm-hmm. So a seller, someone will respond to us and want to sell their property, but come to find out they are not the only owner. There may be multiple heirs that have no idea that they even are a partial owner of the property, or if they did know, they may or may not want to sell. So we have those situations a lot. Someone contacts us, they say, Grandma said I could have this property when she died.
Yes.
They end up taking over and paying the property taxes. They've owned it for quite some time. They're like, well, what's the point of owning this? We never use it or whatever. And then they get under contract to sell it to us. We run the title report and find out that, you know, there are multiple heirs to this property. And they, you know, obviously if there's multiple owners of the property, they all have to, you know, they all have to sign off on the sale. A lot of times these sellers have no contact with these other people. They're long lost distance cousins or something like that. And you're never going to get clear title, clear ownership on those types of properties. So even if they were to just offer it to you at a really cheap price, you're not actually even legally buying the whole property. You you could potentially buy their 1/5 interest in the property or something like that. But to have something that's not even full ownership is kind of worthless in my point of view. So like, what are you going to work out some sort of deal to share it with these unknown people?
Well, a lot of the time you can't even contact them.
Yeah,
you have to do like a full private investigation kind of thing to figure out who these people are, where they actually are in the country or out of the country.
Yeah,
and try and get in contact with them. It's a big process that most of the time doesn't work out.
Yeah. And then even if you did get in contact with them, then it's the next hurdle of like, are they willing to sell for the price that you're willing to pay?
Yeah.
And then you might get 4 out of the 5 that agree. And the 5th one's a holdout. You know? So those types of deals, when they come up, I mean, we just, unless there's one person that's kind of like that you're dealing with that knows all the people involved that, you know, has contact with them or they've all been in agreement to sell and everything like that. Those are just long shots and situations where you're spinning your wheels and not getting anywhere. So we try to get out of those situations as quickly as we can.
Yeah. So, and that kind of brings up a couple things to kind of take note of is the first is you should always ask. When you're communicating with a seller, ask them if they're the only one on the title. And if they're not, if everyone's on board to sell. A lot of the time, they may not know. So it's not foolproof, but it'll at least give you an idea. And the second is you can check. Typically, county records might say who is the owner. You can check the deeds if they have them online. You can do an online search in some counties. Just to kind of try and cover your bases if there's a question. But at the same time, it really proves why title insurance is so important to get.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And it's not even really the title insurance. Well, it is. It's good to have that insurance policy, but they do a comprehensive search to make sure that they're covering their butts.
Yeah.
So that search is the really important thing. Yes. It just digs up a lot of stuff sometimes.
Yeah.
So, okay. And then the other part of that is the legal disputes. So sometimes you might have some sort of lawsuit between the person you're trying to buy from and maybe a neighbor, or maybe there was problem with water runoff or some sort of fence dispute or who knows, you know, legal problems come up or whatever. So I would never buy those types of properties with an open legal dispute like that, just because it's a liability. You don't know how it's going to get resolved unless you're getting it for such an amazing price and liability on that lawsuit you've determined is super low.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there's a situations where you would proceed, but in most cases, I would say not.
And that's, again, a hard thing to find out before you actually move further in the process. But you can utilize some online tools. Like, you can just Google the parcel number, you can Google the owner, see if anything pops up in like a cursory search, if you have the time to be doing that. I don't do that probably as often as I should.
Right.
But it's kind of an extra layer of protection.
Yeah, and that's big, you know, because a lot of these sellers will try to hide stuff like that.
Yes.
You know, they won't come forward with that information, which is obviously very, very relevant. Yeah. But is there anything else we should know? You know, we always ask those open-ended questions that kind of cover a lot of things. And, you know, they're never, well, not saying never, but it's rare that they're going to
volunteer
some of that type of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends who you're dealing with, I guess. But boost your land flipping earnings with our new Land Conquest business system. It's designed for efficiency and effectiveness. This cutting-edge software tool is your key to success in the land flipping industry. Streamline and automate your operations to scale your business to new heights. With our system, you get a customizable website with 6 professional templates to choose from, up to 5 dedicated phone numbers, each with their own chosen area codes for creating a trustworthy local presence. And as a bonus, you'll get a $25 credit for SMS and email sends. You'll also get access to our tech team to build any automations or customizations that you want. And not to mention, we've got a great dedicated community to the Land Conquest business system to help us all thrive together. And with every step of the way, you get our 24/7 live chat support. But that's not all. You'll also gain access to our exclusive community to connect and grow with fellow land flippers. Seize the opportunity to transform your business. Visit software.landconquest.com to check out the Land Conquest business system and unlock the next stage of your land flipping success. Number 7, and our final category, is the environmentally protected land.
Yes.
So this comes up, like, a lot of times it might say something like open space easement or some sort of environmental type easement that is on the property. That would come up either in a title report or in your preliminary search of the property. But basically, it's land that's like set aside for some sort of environmental purpose. It could be some sort of protected habitat of some sort of insect or bird or animal of some sort. Yeah. It could be just land that's kind of set aside that can never be developed for a number of reasons that's done. So land like that, it may have some potential value depending on the specifics of that easement. Like, it may say in the paperwork that, hey, you can use it for recreational purposes, but you can never build. Yeah. It may have some sort of allowances for some things you can do with the property, but a lot of times you have very limited use and as a consequence, very limited value.
Exactly.
So we do see those environmentally protected pieces of land sometimes. Don't we?
Yeah, I would say it's on the rarer side, and it's more common in certain areas than others, but it does come up.
I actually bought and sold a piece of land like that, and I sold it to the neighbor. I bought it because I had the deal lined up before I closed on the purchase.
Okay. Yeah.
And if I didn't have that lined up, I wouldn't have bought it because it would just be tough to sell on the open market. And I did back out on a piece of land that I was under contract to buy one time because I didn't realize it at first. And then I found out that it was an environmentally protected habitat or something like that. And I was just like, well, the whole property was, and there was no use cases to even use it recreationally. So, we just ended up getting out of the deal because you're paying property taxes. You've got some sort of responsibility, with the property to make sure people don't go on it and stuff like that. So, like, it was just not something that would have made sense for us.
No. It's also just another layer of things to deal with. Like, you just have to constantly, it's kind of that mental energy spending on the property. Like, okay, I've got to remember to pay these property taxes. I've got to do, if anything happens, there's going to be paperwork or issues or just expending that mental energy towards it.
It's interesting. You know, we've got a lot of these properties that we own all across the country. I'm never really thinking about them sitting there, I guess, and potential issues and stuff like that. But there's always things that can come up. So anyhow, how did I do on my list? Are there any others that you would add?
I think your list is pretty comprehensive.
Okay.
I guess I would say in kind of those, we typically stay away from commercial properties in small towns.
Yes, that's a really good one, Maddie.
Yeah. That's one I would bring up because it's, I mean, if there isn't any development happening, no one's going to want to buy properties that are zoned only for commercial use.
And not just a small town. Like if the town is on the up and up, like it's a growing town, but it's small, I would find that potentially a viable properties. But if it's an older established town that has gradually been in decline over the years, unless you see some sort of reason for a potential reversal in the near term, those are tough because the commercial heyday has come and gone. You know, maybe it was a stop on the railroad.
Yeah.
Maybe it was a mining town, you know, and the mines have all closed.
Yeah.
You know, so at one point, those commercial pieces of property maybe had some real value.
Yeah.
At this point in time, they don't.
Yeah.
So unless you see something that like, hey, this area is poised for a turnaround because they're opening a lithium mine here or they're, you know, this big company is moving to the town, you know, like something like that, I would really be concerned about those types of properties.
Yeah.
Because again, they carry higher property taxes generally, and the town is kind of, you know, on life support anyhow.
Yeah.
And, you know, buying into that is... you know, it's just not, you know, it's tough to really do anything with it, I guess you could say. And that's another thing that's potential. You know, you could look at properties like that and really decide like, hey, I want to make a big project. I'm going to move a company there. I want to do something, you know, like there's always those types of things to create value.
Yeah.
But it's kind of beyond the scope of what we generally do.
Yes.
You know, we're just buying and selling properties and maybe doing some minor value adds to them, but we're rarely taking things a step further and creating like a reason for a town to be revitalized.
Exactly. So. It's really all about that risk too.
Yes.
The risk factor. It could work out really well if you were to move a company there or something or do anything like that. But I mean, there's always a chance that it won't.
Yes. That's right. I think that's a pretty comprehensive list. And hopefully we got across the point that not all land is worth buying.
No.
You know, and even at the right price, we're definitely not buying some of these types of properties, you know. And another, I guess, kind of another thing that happens to us a lot is that we get a lot of leads in, especially through the pay-per-click as well. Mm-hmm. You know, these properties may be worth, say, $5,000, $7,000, like on a resale side of things, like retail value.
Yeah.
And potentially we could buy them for $1,000 or $2,000 or something like that.
Yep.
But we decline those because, you know, you've got transaction costs on the buy side, on the resale side. You've also got selling expenses, you know, like if you're going to use a real estate agent, you'll have to pay commissions. And first of all, there's not many real estate agents that would take a $7,000 listing, you know, unless they're doing you a favor. So those types of properties, you know, maybe there's money to be had. Like if you were going to just buy it direct and you were going to then just sell it direct, you know, maybe maybe it's worth your time or whatever to do those. But for our business and the way we're set up, it simply is not worth it.
No, not worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if someone were to deed it to us.
Exactly. Yeah, because it just...
I know it doesn't make much sense.
No,
but
just the profit isn't there.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Maybe if we were set up in a different way where we could just, we put them all on Facebook Marketplace and sold them that way or whatever. But then you got to have a team and the kind of manage those leads and you know, talk to the people directly and work out the deals and all this kind of stuff. So it's simply for us, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
No. But,
all right. So now we will progress to the next section of the Turning Profit podcast, which is where we answer questions from our community.
Amazing.
So the community, by the way, if you haven't heard, is called Land Conquest, and it is hosted on the School platform, and that's spelled S-K-O-O-L. So if you go to school.com/landconquest, you will be able to find our community. Mm-hmm. We've got like 4,200 people or something.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
It's
so,
a good group.
Yeah, it really is a good group. We've got all kinds of things that we do for free training in the community. Yep. We have some regular deal evaluation calls, we call it, where we're basically members submit potential deals that they've got. Mm-hmm. We share a screen and kind of go through all of these deals that come in, let you know how we evaluate the properties and determine what we think they're worth.
Yeah.
So those are fun and very insightful, those calls.
Yeah.
We're also doing some other, we've got some other webinars coming up about different aspects of land investing. So that's kind of exciting. So if you're interested, check us out at the Land Conquest community.
Yes.
And you'll see us in there interacting as well.
Yep.
We cherry-picked four questions, or I cherry-picked four questions from the community, and Maddie is going to read them off.
Yes.
And I'll do my best to answer them.
All right.
Here and since I supplied the questions, I think I might be able to answer them.
We'll see. Okay. First question is from Brandon. The topic is mailers. He says, first mailer sent out a couple weeks ago. Got one call today, but the guy only owned the mineral rights, not the land. But fun to know people do open the letters and there is potential. Second batch of mailers sent today.
Well, that's great. That's exciting to get the leads coming in. And so it kind of makes it more real when the phone starts ringing. You start getting the emails and texts and everything. Mm-hmm. So that is exciting. But I wanted to highlight that question because he mentioned that someone only wanted to sell the mineral rights.
Yes.
So that was kind of a new concept to me when I started out. I didn't understand, well, what does this mean, mineral rights or land? Like, doesn't land just mean like, you've got the rights to everything, but that's not the case.
No.
Well, in a lot of areas, there is a big difference between the actual physical land and the mineral rights. They're kind of two separate things. And sometimes you buy the land and it includes the mineral rights. Mm-hmm. Sometimes those mineral rights were sold off to some other, you know, in some of these oil areas, you know, it was sold off to some other company that has the rights to actually drill for oil on your property. They can have an big oil rig on your property, or they could maybe have the potential to mine the property for some sort of minerals or something like that. So you can own the land, but they have the right to actually drill and use it for that purpose.
Yeah.
So certain areas, it comes into play a lot. Mm-hmm. And then you can also, as mentioned here, what Brandon said, that you can actually sell off those rights by themselves, you know, without the land involved at all. So there's a whole market for that, actually. Yeah. And for some areas where oil and minerals are a big thing, then...
be a big deal.
Yeah. But, you know, sometimes we'll buy properties without mineral rights just because it's kind of like in certain areas, you know, it's common. They've already been sold off in a lot of cases. But but we're not in the business of actually buying just the mineral rights. That's a whole different thing. And, and there's value to them. I just I have no way of determining what that value is.
Yeah, no, it's not like there's an MLS for mineral rights or anything like that.
Yes, you've got to sort of specialize in that and really understand what the potential of that property is, or the mineral, oil, gas, and mineral rights are for that area. So
I kind of think that's where having a good broker or agent contact is great to have, because they can tell you know, if you have a piece of property and the mineral rights aren't included, you can ask them like, hey, is this typical for this area, or is a potential buyer going to be scared away? They can tell you give you some insight on that situation.
Very good point, because each area is different.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just the standard that none of these properties come with mineral rights. Mm-hmm. It's just, you're always just selling the land. Mm-hmm. And in some areas might be weird that it doesn't include the mineral rights. Mm-hmm. You know, the oil, gas, mineral rights. So, and that's a whole other thing too. So you can actually hire companies that will research these oil, gas, and mineral rights for these properties. And a lot of the title companies will say, well, their search doesn't include oil, gas, and mineral rights. Mm-hmm. So you can hire a separate company to do those types of searches if it's a big deal, if it could potentially add a lot of value to the property, something like that, to be able to transfer that with it. So that's a common use case, a common thing that comes up in certain areas.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to the next question. This is from Steven. Road access / easement question. Seller has a property with road access through a lot owned by their cousin via an easement. How much would this affect the value of the property? Thanks.
Yeah, so there's a lot of variables there, so it doesn't make sense for me to say, okay, well, that affects it $10,000, because I don't know what, you know, there's just a lot of things that come into play there, like how long is this easement? When you're going through the cousin's property, are you like basically using the cousin's driveway and driving past their house and their chicken coops, or, you know, like, so it depends on the situation there, or is it just like kind of doesn't appear that you're encroaching on the you know, the cousins, what they've got going on.
Of something.
Yeah, exactly. So there's just a lot of factors involved, and you kind of have to look at the whole situation and determine it. generally, it's always better to have road frontage. Yeah. That's what most people want. But there are a lot of great properties that are accessed through an easement, and that could be, you know, that there's nothing wrong with that, but it just does affect the value negatively sometimes. So, but how much, it just depends on the situation.
Yeah, typically best if you can find comps that are also accessed by easement.
Yeah, and if you can't find that, then at very least adjust it for not having road frontage, like make a deduction on the potential resale value.
Try to make note of if the easement is cleared already, because if it's not, if it's just on paper, and you have to go through like a jungle to get to this property, that's kind of a whole separate ball game.
Yeah.
And then the quality of the road too, if there is a road there, if it's like this crazy bumpy road and you don't want to spend the money to kind of fix it up, that also affects potential buyers wanting to buy the property.
Yeah, so sometimes, like, we see these sometimes where it's like a half-mile easement.
Yeah.
And it's showing on paper, but in reality, it's just simply not there. Yeah. I mean, like, you could walk there, maybe, but there's no road, so you would have to build a road. Even if it's a gravel road, believe me, they're expensive to do it right, you know? So you'd have to maybe clear trees and brush and everything, and then get it graded, and then hire someone to put in gravel and drainage and, you know, pipe. If you're covering any, going over any streams or something like that, then you got to build like a culvert over it and everything. So all those things add a lot of costs. And if you're building this super expensive road to get to this property that's not super high dollar property in the first place, you know, you got to kind of look at all these factors. Is it really, you know, is it really worth it?
Yeah. Plus time too.
Time.
You might not be able to get contractors out there quickly. Just the entire process as a whole of actually building out that road can take a while. And you might have to do some cost benefit analysis on if spending this time is going to be worth it for you, or if you have other leads you can focus on.
Are you looking for funding for your land flipping deal? Then head on over to partnerwithpete.com. It's an innovative new funding program where we split the profits with you 50-50, but we take it one step further and we handle every other step of the process in the land flipping business. Yes, that means we handle all the due diligence. If the property needs any value add, like clearing brush, perk test, survey, we'll get that paid for up front. Then when the property resells, we split the profits 50-50. There is absolutely no downside for you as an investor. If we lose money, we don't pass that on to you. But when we make money, when we make profit, we split the proceeds 50-50. So as a recap, we handle every part of the process. We split the profits with you 50-50. There's no downside for you as the investor, only upside. So go to partnerwithpete.com, submit your deal there, and we'll get it checked out within 24 hours. And sometimes the neighbors get squirrely as well, meaning like they, on paper, it shows an easement going through their property or something like that. But they either, sometimes they don't know it. They actually don't know that there is an easement there, or they just figured it's been so long that no one's ever used that, that it's not, you know, it doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And then if you come in there with, you know, hire a bulldozer to come through their, you know, property that they own, but they didn't know that or didn't realize an easement was actually going to go through there, they start getting, you know, squirrely, and some just put up a big, you know, stink about it, and you might have to like take them to court or something like that, and then it's just a bad situation and something you want to avoid in some cases. So
all right, let's move on to the next question. Let's see here, this is from John. Says signed PA needs counteroffer. You get a signed PA on a blind offer, but after due diligence, you realize the offer is too high. How do you handle the situation? Obviously, I'm sure it is best to call and communicate with the owner. If you come to agreement on a new purchase price amount, do you send a new PA with a revised price back to the owner for a new signature?
Technically, you could do that in a couple different ways. You could send them a new purchase agreement. You know, we do a lot of electronic signatures. So if we have a seller that is open to that, we'll just do a new purchase agreement. We'll send it to them, you know, for electronic signature. It's just quick and easy. They don't have to like print and you know, like, you know, scan it then, or, you know, do any of these things. Like, it's just simply they click through their email and just sign it. And that's, but if it's a situation where they've got the original still, you can always have them line through the old price, write the new price on there. but also initial beside it. Mm-hmm. And then they could take a picture and send it back to you, you know, like if that's easiest. But a lot of times we'll just send out a new one.
Yeah.
But different situations call for different, you know, ways to handle that. But
exactly.
Yeah. And by the way, that happens a lot.
Oh, yeah. You know?
So the offer prices that we send out are just based off of averages.
Yeah.
So, and we don't know what these individual properties look like, if they're average, below average, above average, really, until we can look at them specifically. Exactly. And sometimes we have to adapt, you know. Yeah. Sometimes we are able to come up in our prices.
Yeah.
Sometimes the prices that's on there we can't do because it's simply there's issues with the property.
Yeah. So, it's a below average property.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, I mean, it's really only as good as the data we have.
Yep.
So it could have been that, you know, the comps that we used to make our pricing for the mailers were unusually good for that area, but they were the best ones that we had available at that time. And it could have been that now there are some new ones on the market and they're cheaper, or not on the market, that have been sold that are cheaper and technically would have been better for us to use, but they weren't available then.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of just about, yeah, it really is. You're only as good as the data you have.
I think in the future, and I know this is going to be coming, like we'll be able to build AI tools that will be able to adapt the offer price according to how, you know, it may grade the properties. You know, maybe we come up with a scale like property from like 1 to 10 on a scale of like from least desirable to most desirable.
Yeah.
And then the offer price changes accordingly. So and this could all happen like automatically without us having to manually do all this.
Wow.
You know, so
yeah,
that's coming. I think we could figure that out, you know, at some point here in the near future. And obviously, if we're able to get more exact with our, you know, offer pricing, then we're going to have a lot less of those issues and maybe more acceptance and, you know, that type of thing. But coming in the future.
Yeah, because I know there are tools out there that like kind of claim to do that, where they kind of adjust the pricing, but they don't really actually get in depth and kind of evaluate them on a case by case basis and doing that apples to apples evaluation that we do. They kind of base it on a kind of a more in depth average.
Yes.
But that doesn't always work. So in the future, hopefully, yeah.
I know it's possible. It's just simply a matter of like training it with all the data and getting it done. So it would have to be something that I hired someone or hired a team of people to focus on in order to make it happen. But, you know, maybe sometime in the near future, I'll invest in that.
Yeah. Keep an eye out.
Yes, keep an eye out. Yes.
Let's do our next question. What we have here, this is from Jim. It says, leads. Hey, everybody. In your own personal experience, what do you think is the most effective? Cold calling, text messages, or sending out mail? I'm getting started with generating my own leads through Land Portal and want all the feedback I can get. Thank you, guys.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I don't know what Land Portal is.
I don't know either.
Yeah. We've got experience with direct mail. Obviously, that's where we generated the majority of our deals over the years. So obviously, we're big fans of direct mail.
Yeah.
We talk about that all the time. Cold calling, we did experiment with cold calling for a while. We used a service for almost 6 months, maybe 5-6 months, something like that where we invested about $10,000 a month. And we just had very limited success with it. We got a lot of leads in. But most all of the leads were very low quality leads, meaning they'd be interested in selling, but their pricing was always like retail or mostly retail plus.
Yes.
You know, like
lot of retail plus.
Not just market price, but way above market price.
Yes. Like not even in the same realm.
But what's funny is when you run into these, it's a strange phenomenon because when you run into people that are interested in selling, but they've got this ultra high price in their mind, those are the people most interested in talking to you. Like they will talk your ear off about this property, tell you how great it is and everything like that. So they're very receptive to any phone calls that someone would say, you know, hey, are you interested in selling?
Yeah.
It's just that you come to discover that those leads are a waste of time because they're never going to be in the range where you need it to be in order to make it happen. Cold calling didn't work for us. I'm not saying it doesn't work. It just didn't work for us in the system that we've got. I know it works, but text messaging. We've never done text messaging. About a year and a half ago, I was really considering, you know, stepping in and putting a system to do the text messaging in place. Then there started getting to be a lot more scrutiny from the cellular carriers about text messages and text message spam and all that kind of stuff. So they really cracked down this past year and put a lot of restrictions on that. And from what I'm told, it's from what I'm told from other investors that are still doing it or were previously doing it, is that it made it a lot more difficult.
Yes.
You know, so your messages have to be compliant. Mm-hmm. And in order to be compliant, I don't know all the rules behind this, but basically the messaging you have to send is not the type of messaging that gets a good response.
No.
So, and you can't just say whatever you want or you'll get blocked. Yeah. Carriers will actually just block it.
Yeah, text messaging worries me. Mm-hmm. There's just so much you have to keep track of and make sure that you're compliant with. And I just don't think people are receptive enough to... Yeah, to make it worth it.
I think there was a golden age of it for a while. Yeah. Like it really worked, and it was very productive and did great. But I think that golden age is over. Just in my opinion, just from what I'm hearing, this is not from personal experience, but
not a scientific outlook at it. It's just from what you're hearing.
Yes, and you mentioned in the question as well about. Just those three things, but also pay-per-click is a viable method of generating leads as well. Yeah. It just depends what you're looking for. And like I said, we did an episode 2 weeks ago on pay-per-click and kind of what was happening within our business with that. So that's a very interesting thing, especially if you can put the automation in place to respond and qualify those leads as they come in instantly, with our AI bot that we have in our Lane Conquest business system. Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty essential if you're going to do that type of lead generation.
Yeah, because these are people who want results or they want responses. They want to move along in the process right away. They're interested right at that moment. And if you don't capture them right then you're going to have diminished returns.
Exactly. Yeah. You'll never be able to get hold of some of these people again. Yeah. You know, if you wait 24 hours to respond to them.
Because the moment's passed.
Yeah.
They're not interested anymore.
Right.
Or they don't have time anymore.
They may have filled out a different form online. Exactly. You know, someone else that then responded to them right away and worked out a deal.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing. So we're focused on direct mail and pay-per-click advertising. That's our lead generation. And also we get a lot of deals too from our partner program.
Yes.
And if you haven't heard about that, you can find out information at partnerwithpete.com.
Yes.
And essentially what we do is we are the money partner and not just the money partner, but we will also handle the entire process of the deal from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. And you may not really, if you're new to land investing, you may not realize everything that goes into it, but there's a lot of stuff that happens.
A lot of moving pieces.
After you get the contract signed.
Yeah.
So in order to do it right, you know, there's due diligence. There's an entire extensive due diligence process that we do. Mm-hmm. You may have tests that you need to pay for, like a perk test or getting a survey done or something like that. And then you've got the transaction with the title report and getting that all done. Then you've got the marketing side of like hiring a good real estate agent or broker in order to sell the property and staying on top of them and negotiating any deals that come in. Mm-hmm. Handling the transaction on the resale side and, you know, dealing with any issues that come up along the way. There are always issues, you know? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so our program is set up in the way that, like, if you have a deal, you submit it at partnerwithpete.com.
Yes.
If it's a deal that matches our criteria and everything, then we will agree to fund the deal, meaning we will use our money to actually close on the deal and pay for it and everything like that. You don't have to come up with any money out of your own pocket. Yeah. We handle all the other stuff. And then when it resells, we split the profits 50-50.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's a real win-win type setup. As the investor, there's no downside because, you know, if we were to lose money on a deal or something like that, that doesn't come back on the investor at all.
No.
But the investor captures 50% of the upside, which is a pretty cool thing.
Mm-hmm. Just for bringing in the deal.
Just for bringing the deal.
Yeah.
So I always tell us... any of the investors that we deal with, like, hey, you focus on just getting deals and we'll take care of all this other stuff and we'll do our best to make it as profitable as possible. Yeah. And, you know, so we each have as big of a check as possible at the end.
Yeah. And we have a lot of investors who do that.
Yes.
Who really just are focused on getting those deals coming in.
Yeah.
And they partnered with us multiple times.
Yeah.
So those are really good ones because got to develop kind of a rapport, and
yep,
you know that they're going to be bringing in some good deals, and
yeah, that's fun. I love doing repeat business, you know, yeah. And that's you know, I really, anything we do, we try to make it a win-win. So yeah. That's I really feel like that program is set up that way.
Yeah, I think it's pretty unique.
Yep. So again, that's partnerwithpete.com. Yes. And then if you want to follow me on Instagram, it's @partnerwithpete, mm-hmm. And is on TikTok as well, @partnerwithpete.
Yes.
We just post short clip videos there. On YouTube, I'd love it if you check out our YouTube channel. We post this podcast every week, the video version of it. But we also have other videos that we post there regularly as well.
Yeah.
And you can find that by just searching for @turningprofit. And that's where you'll find the YouTube channel.
Yeah, some good stuff there.
Yep.
I recommend checking it out.
So I guess that's about it. Did you have anything else you want to add today, Maddie?
No, I think we've covered everything.
Okay, well, yeah. It was great having you as a co-host. You did an amazing job.
Thank you.
So
had a good time.
Heather should be worried.
I know. I'm going to keep her out.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for watching or listening, and have a great day.
Thank you.
All right.
Ready to start turning profit yourself? Head to turningprofit.com to step up your real estate investing game. See you on the next episode.